is very pretty.
That's a little busker sound check. Tune my DJ voice, which is surprisingly similar to my regular voice since I have
since you're a
dynamic
DJ.
Monotone.
You know what scared me is when you said, like, this week sometime that, or last week, you were like, I was thinking of taking voice lessons.
For singing or for speaking?
Speaking. No. Singing.
Why'd that scare you?
Because Rose thinks I have a good voice, and I think I have plenty of room for improvement. Just the usage of
the usage of your instrument. But we've never, we've always believed, you know, the punk rock. You know, you don't have to be good at this.
That's true.
I mean, would you tell somebody to take guitar lessons?
No. Not even, I wasn't really saying voice lessons, just somebody who knows, you know.
Get a few tips.
Yeah. You know, like how Madonna's voice changed?
From high to low?
When she
took voice lessons.
Hmm.
I didn't know that. I thought it was just a function of aging.
Well, yeah, it was probably part of it, but I think some of it had to do with, I think she was getting vocal coaching and stuff, whereas before she just sort of sang.
So you'll start singing lower?
I don't know. It was just
in response to me saying I wanted to take some voice lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Clock Street doesn't have a clock.
Yeah. I can sing that low. I can sing that low. What is that? What is that? I can talk that fast. That's from True Stories. What were we talking about? Do we have anything? We have something to talk about, don't we?
Your thesis?
Oh, that's right.
Okay.
Because it tied in. You see, the problem is that the last segment we did, we paused for 15 minutes, and now we can't remember what we were talking about. But this connects into what we were talking about, even though I can't remember it.
We had to bring Rose to the hospital, and then they wouldn't take her in.
Because of all those doctor comments.
Right.
Yeah, you better watch out who you diss in this town.
Like that one Seinfeld episode with Elaine trying to get her chart.
I do know that one. I saw that one before we stopped watching TV. They're all terrible. Except for that one woman that we went to that was really nice.
Oh, the one who gave us shots?
Yeah.
I think she was a nurse practitioner.
Figures.
Yeah.
I wanted to find out like how to see her again. All she can do is give us shots, right?
Yeah,
she can't,
you know,
like,
next time
us.
You need a tetanus shot, I'm sure you can get her.
She was awesome.
She could probably do just as much as a doctor could to a certain point.
Probably more in this town. I've had bad experiences with doctors, such bad experiences here that I don't see how dissing on them would hurt me.
There was an article in the Daily Line about this woman. Last week she went to the U of I, whatever, doctors, and they told her to, they asked her about her sexual, is she, you know, sexually active, and then they gave her some sort of, like, antibiotics to take with her, and that's it. And then, like, 4 hours later, she was at another hospital, and she had her appendix taken out.
Oh my God. That was like when I had mono here, remember? I was, like, laying on the cabinet, on the filing cabinet. I've been waiting for like a couple of hours to get into McKinley, it wasn't McKinley. It was the real hospital here.
Carl.
And I was I don't even remember which one. I was laying there sweating. I was so hot, and I was laying against this cool filing cabinet because it was cold. It was the only thing keeping my body cold, and I was just laying there. And then they called me in, and I came in, and I was like, I was so, my throat was killing me, and the doctor said, "So what seems to be the problem?" I'm like, my throat hurts and I feel really terrible. And he was like, "Well, what do you think is wrong with you?" And I was like, "Well, my throat hurts. I don't know. Maybe I have strep." And like, so he's like, "Okay, let's do a strep culture." And then like, I went home to my parents' house. Remember? And
I remember that you bought a car.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll finish the whole story. You know, the test came back that I didn't have strep. But I went home finally because I was so sick to my parents' house, and like my parents took me to a pediatrician. May he rest in peace, but you know, he was still alive back then. He looked at me and he goes, "You have mono." And I went, "Oh, that's what it was." Because he gave me some kind of test for mono, and then I went out and bought a car, and then they called me. I was too sick to drive, to test drive the car. So the guy who was selling me the car test drove it. This was Highland Park. This is the Acura dealership in Highland Park. And when I got back,
but you bought an Oldsmobile.
No, I bought a Peugeot. Wasn't it a Peugeot?
It was an Oldsmobile.
Okay. Well, it was a used car.
You weren't sick the whole time you had the car. You had the car when you were healthy, too. You don't remember it, do you?
No, no.
It was an Oldsmobile, like one of those hatchback Oldsmobiles. Anyways.
But, and they called me while I was signing the papers to buy the car. The doctor called and said I had mono. He called me at the car dealership.
Was this the same doctor that diagnosed your thyroid problem by just looking at
it? It was another one.
Oh. Rosa has a history of having doctors, you know, going through tests for all sorts of things and then them finding nothing, and then like a doctor her dad knows will like look at her and say, "You have this."
Well, you know what? I mean, he looks at me and they all look at my neck and they see there's either my glands are swollen or my thyroid is swollen. And they know there's something wrong with me. Meanwhile, Rick has a history of never having gone to a doctor ever his whole life.
No, I went to the
doctor.
Except
for that one time you turned bright yellow.
No, I would go regularly when I was under the care of my parents, but ever since I've been in control of my own destiny, I've been bad. I haven't been to the doctor. I haven't had a regular checkup for over. We shouldn't talk about this because my parents are listening.
You have to have a doctor stick his finger up your butt.
Is it time for me to do that yet? What age do they start doing that?
Probably now. You should definitely, the way you live, doctor should definitely stick his finger up your butt.
Or
what
grab
is that?
Your
yeah.
something.
That's upsetting.
Do you think your parents are listening to this?
No, I don't think they do.
Yeah, then the doctor has to grab your testicles and make you cough too, right? Or do they stick your... See, you don't even know.
Prostate.
You don't even know.
Yeah, prostate, yeah.
You should have your prostate looked at, Rick.
You think?
Yeah, I do.
I don't know. I thought I had another couple of years before.
I'll have my boob felt if you get your prostate.
Okay. It's a deal.
What about your medical history?
Maybe you guys can examine each other.
Ew!
It might lead to something.
Yuck.
So, your thesis. Let's talk about your thesis.
I was born with spina bifida. I was.
What's
really?
That?
I don't know fully, but I could have been at the bottom of my spine. I have a scar here at the bottom of my spine where they like remove something when I was born.
Did you have like a tail?
No, it was like a sack of fluid.
Mm.
And if it would have burst, it could have gotten into my brain somehow. And
yeah, because I always thought that was something really, really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's something that can be treated.
I was... turned out okay, but not yeah. everybody does. They either, I think you become mentally retarded. I'm not sure. Maybe I shouldn't talk about it, but
mm-hmm.
a lot of bad stuff can happen from it.
Yeah, well, so, you're lucky.
Anyways, it's so weird being a guest because I'm like just talking about myself.
That's what it's all about. I know.
Promote my movie and my book.
Well, see, that's the I
my
like
new
the idea.
Restaurant.
I like the idea of having people who are not. Famous for some reason being interviewed, because to me every radio show I've heard with regular people talking about themselves is really interesting.
Fascinating.
To me. Yeah. So I have no problem with you talking about yourself.
Okay.
My brother had to operate on him when he was in the right after he was born because
to separate you guys?
No. No, he was yeah. He was no, he's 2 years younger than me. But he had something where that like there's like a flap in your stomach or your stomach's you can't take food in or something like that, and they had to cut him open after like a day or two after he was born.
Poor Jim.
Yeah.
It's amazing when you think about it that if you're born healthy, of all the things that could go
yeah,
wrong.
That's what terrifies. I mean, yeah, when we talk about having kids, that's what terrifies me the most is like, oh, you know.
Because of all those drugs we did, we'll
in the
have a
60s.
Child with like a fourth eye.
Yeah.
And you could...
And a third eye.
So you want to hear about my thesis?
Yeah.
Okay. I have a master's degree in sociology, so I'm just one of those people that seems to be in school often. But ever since I was a kid, I've seen whenever we had to pick something in school to write about, I always managed to write about rock music. Basically, from I can go back to probably third grade and talking about Kiss and Show and Tell or something, all the way into high school and then into college. I remember writing about Live Aid and all that kind of stuff for my like senior in high school term paper, and which I got a lot of mileage out of that paper. I handed it in like 3 times in high school and 1 time in college.
That's funny.
Wow.
And I got the first time I got handed in was to an English teacher. That's why I wrote the paper in the first place. I think I got a C-. And I handed in the same paper the other times, and I've got, like, A's and B's. I changed it, like, a little bit, very minutely. Anyway, so when I got to grad school in sociology, I thought, well, I still like music a lot, rock music. And I had met the band from Bloomington, the Something Brothers, and by this time it was 94 and they were already broken up, and I was trying to make it sociological and to tie into the last segment we were talking about how no one stays in a job usually their whole life, or even sadly though enough people with their relationships and divorce and all that. So there's this theme of role exit, and there was this book written called Becoming an Ex, and it's written by this woman named Helen Rose Ebaugh, and she has a PhD in sociology, I think is in Texas. She used to be a nun, and she left, what do you call it, the convent?
Mm-hmm.
Or the sisterhood, I guess.
Sisterhood, yeah.
And then a week later, she met a man who was about to be, who'd be her husband later, and he had just gotten a divorce. And she realized that, you know what, and she was still a sociologist at this time, too. She realized, you know what, he seems to be going through similar things that I'm going through, even though we left completely different roles.
Hmm.
You know, he got a divorce, I left the sisterhood. And then she, her book, that kind of gave her an idea, I guess, to start to write the book. And she interviewed people who were ex-doctors, people who left the medical profession, which you don't hear about that much.
Yeah, yeah.
My cousin.
There you go. She interviewed recovering alcoholics. She interviewed people who were changing their gender.
Mm-hmm.
She interviewed mothers who gave up custody of their children.
Wow.
And she found, you know, those are varying things. And what I love about sociology is it looks at something, and well, I guess other scientific fields do this too, but looks at things and tries to see a common thread that runs through stuff. And she found common threads that ran through all these varying roles that people would leave. And so what I did is, or her book looked at people who willingly left their role. All those people chose to leave. They weren't really forced to. And mine, where mine differed then, because you have to kind of do a little bit different, is I wanted to see if people, how people left a role that they were, I thought, forced to leave.
Hmm.
They were a 6-member band, and there's problems with one member, according to the other 5. And it's almost like the role exit was forced on the other 5 in some respects. And what I found is that the role exit process was fairly similar. And this is only, you can't have a statistical generalization, you know, to the larger population. But with 6 people, they went through similar things that the people that Helen Rose Ebaugh discovered. But they went through it afterwards.
Mm.
There's like 4 stages of role exit. The first stage is, see if I'll remember these stages, is I think just kind of realizing you're not happy with what's going on. And then the second stage is, I think, seeking alternative roles. Like, okay, I'm not happy. What else could I be doing? And then the third, I might be getting the third stage mixed up with that. And I don't remember the third stage right now, but the fourth stage is you leave the role.
Mm-hmm.
And some people you don't always go 1, 2, 3, 4. They go 1, 2, 1. You know, they kind of jump back around, and some people get to the third stage and they never leave. They just say, okay, I'm staying. And the, you know, or like Michael Jordan retiring from basketball and then right. going back into basketball, like that's role exit and role reentry. And so, and a lot of the literature out there was like on people acquiring roles, like, you know, getting a new role, but there really wasn't much out there about what happens when people leave a role. And it's, as we were talking earlier in the other segment, it's more common in our society for people to have multiple roles, but also be leaving roles and trying new roles. And that's kind of what I studied them as a band, and sort of the demise of the band.
Wow.
And how it came down.
This is like a joke question almost. We're all going to laugh. I was going to say, did you help in the demise of the band? You know, of course.
No, they're already broken up.
It almost seems like I wanted to say that forced role exit, probably does that, like, well, I was going to say it probably skips the one stage where the person is thinking what else could they do, but they probably think about it after.
Yeah, because they have to think about it.
Right.
And another sort of theme was identity transformation, because your role exit and identity.
It's interesting that you're talking about this now.
Problem. Yeah, okay. Because everybody knew them as so-and-so from this band. You know, like people say the Poster Children were broken up. That's Rose from the Poster Children or Rick from the Poster Children. And what are they going to say, you know, 50 years from now?
Yeah. And
hopefully you guys will still be together as a band.
That's the thing.
But
I was.
Who are you going to be? You know,
right. When your identity is.
I'm Matt from Ruth Buzzy.
Yeah.
Like, but to some people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And when that band's gone, what do people. You get to, like. And role exits then also not only affect you, they affect people around you that know you personally, but also people that kind of, depending on what job you have, if it's music or art or entertaining, that people you don't even know still have to kind of get used to you. Like, oh, they're not, I can't say that, you know, David Lee Roth of Van Halen. You
know? Yeah, no, it's really, I mean, I've been thinking about this for like the past week, actually, because I, you know, I have like these crossover things that happen where, like, in my job, I'm using Rose, my role is Rose from Poster Children to get something. And then, like, you know, I have to explain to my boss, you know, maybe somehow, you know, like, it's almost like, and when I'm taking this different role, I feel totally different, you know? I mean, when I'm Rose from Poster Children, you know, I feel pretty good, but when I'm not, I, you know, stay up at night and bite my arms, you know, and cry, you know? So this is a very, and you know, I was wondering about you, Rick. I mean, you know, you have an area now where you're not Rick at Poster Children, and well, you've dealt with it really well, probably because you, whenever you were Rick from Rick at Poster Children,
I always had identity problems because I'd get off the stage and then, you know, people
nobody knew who he was.
Didn't know who I was. You know, they would say, I've had somebody say to me that was a pretty good band, wasn't it? And I'd be like, yeah. Or, you know,
I've had
I'd
people
sell
say
them
that.
A T-shirt and they'd say, do you know the band? You know,
that happened to me all the time, though.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I think I don't
you
have.
You could hide better.
I tend to think of myself as a non-person in a weird way. I know that's probably very unhealthy. But I don't have. Yeah, not like that. I mean that I feel like I am an anonymous person within everywhere that I go, kind of.
And you love that too,
yeah,
which is really
I have no
totally
problem
freaks
with
me out. I don't know.
I think that's kind of contradictory for a lot of people who play music, maybe. I don't know.
Are you a good observer?
I think I am, yeah. I think I'm.
He is. He's a great observer.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be helpful as an artist or musician, mm-hmm. getting ideas and.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. So I don't have a problem with my identity. Well, I do have a problem with my identity, but it's not tied to being in the band or working. It has to do with the fact that I think I view myself as a non-person. But not as when I say non-person, I don't mean that I think I'm a robot. I think that I'm not a person that is. It's hard for me to explain.
Why don't you try? Give us an example.
So it feels like a therapy session here.
Oh, it's really cool.
It's hard for me to describe. I think it's because I have an outsider mentality, but it's not even that. I feel outside the outsiders, like even though I am part of the indie rock scene or whatever, I don't feel like I'm a part of it. I feel like I'm outside of that scene too.
Well, yeah, we've always felt like that, but
being at work or something, I feel outside of that sphere of people. I mean, I'm a graphic designer, but I have a computer background, programming background, but none of the programmers know that. So to them, I'm just a designer guy, and I don't have, you know, the knowledge that they have in their minds, you know. And I probably don't, but I mean, I have a little more knowledge than they view it as. And also, I don't think I dress weird, really. So I think I'm kind of innocuous, is what I'm saying. I try not to draw attention to myself.
Which my wife Lene would say that's a good thing, because too many people are like, you think of like politicians or the people who are always like, hey, and everybody thinks, oh, they're so dynamic. Like, she can't stand that because she has a radar. She's in her inside herself where she gets good or bad vibes about people. And it's not always scientifically reliable, but she thinks it quite often is. And from what I've seen, from what I've known her, it is. And so she would think probably good things about you because you're not the person who's like, you know, like shaking everybody's hand with the smile and the little ting, you know.
I thought this was my line to describe myself that I had just remembered, is that I may have done some interesting things, but I'm not really that interesting of a person. That's the way I view it. It's like, I've done a lot of interesting things, but I think when it comes down to it, I'm not that, you know. It's like being around me is not actually that interesting.
You're so weird.
Are
you're
you
like the only person. Rick, like when I first met him, he's like, oh no, I'm just average. Like, you're the only person I know who like strives to be average when you're
so
above average.
No, that's not
true
at all. I think I see value in lots of different people, whereas other people would say, oh, this person's special, this person's not. Whereas I believe in the idea that
everybody is special in some way.
Not even that the differences between people are a lot smaller than, you know, what you're led to believe. You're led to believe that there are special people and there are people who aren't special, and especially in things like music. The way the society has been set up now is that in art and things like that, there are people who have a gift and there are people who don't. Whereas in the past, music was a part of everyone's life, making music. If you wanted to hear music, you had to make it.
Right.
And it didn't matter how good of a musician you were or how good a voice you had. Music was a part of your life. Making music was a part of your life. Whereas now, it's like the special people make music and then everybody else just consumes it. And so that's kind of that average thing, I think, is part of that. It's like, you know, these
You're
people
saying
are
everybody's
stupid.
Average.
Kind of.
Well, there's gifts that everybody has that they're good at. Mm-hmm. But then there's also, you know.
You're saying you're not above everybody else, above anybody else. This is why you don't like the Fountainhead.
Yeah.
It goes against everything you believe.
I guess.
I guess I get
upset with people individually, but I feel as a whole that people are not as I don't like thinking about special people. I don't like special people. I don't like people who get deemed as special and deserving of more attention.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you don't have any heroes that.
So therefore, I could not like myself if I felt I was deserving of attention.
Yeah.
What about the Special Olympics? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, well, you see, the contradiction there is, well, why would I be in a band and play music in front of people then? So there, see, that's where it all breaks down. See, so I'm
somewhere
not...
inside you, you're like, yeah, I'm special.
I'm in a band.
You people suck.
<me. laughs> Adore me.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm an enigma.
Well, everybody's life has contradictions in it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, you have to.
Except
that's,
mine.
That's actually, yeah, that's I read that too, is that, you know, they did that study of supposedly healthy people, mentally healthy people, and they found that, you know, if you look at it, they have really messed up ways of looking at the world. It's like whenever something goes wrong, they blame someone else. Whenever something goes right, they take credit for it, at least in their minds. I mean, they're
and
not.
And those are healthy people.
Those are people who
can,
you know,
function in society.
Can function in society, have never really had any big mental health problems, haven't had problems with depression. You know, they have a very unhealthy view of the world or unrealistic view of the world, but they live in the world and they're happy in the world.
I heard a term for that. It's having an inflated sense of self-worth.
Yeah. Exactly. I think you have to have that to be a
salesperson.
Yeah.
But I think men do that more than have
yeah,
it,
my
more
dad.
Than
that's my dad, totally to a T.
Inflated sense of self-worth.
No, I think he's worth a lot, but he just, you know, he's, yeah. If somebody yells at him and says, "You know, you asshole, you did this wrong or something," he just like, he just doesn't even hear it.
Oh,
whereas,
yeah.
Like, if somebody looks cross-eyed at me or you, you know, we like, I think that guy just looked cross-eyed at me. You know, you'll be driving down the street and a car will honk and you'll be like, who honked at me?
I'm that way, too.
Yeah.
Are you like that?
How, we're all together.
Yeah.
in this little room here.
Let's start our own society.
Yeah. It's, yeah, I don't know. Anyways, I'm getting all uncomfortable now. Talking a little too
much
about
me. It was really cool
me.
Listening to you talk about yourself there.
Yeah.
He's looking at the computer
the
now.
Here.
Okay, we should stop. That's what you're thinking.
It is, yeah, we've got an hour and a half of material here.
Got a week to listen to it.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, this was great. I think this was our great experiment. We were like, we started talking about having guests,
success.
And we thought, yeah.
I can
why
tell.
And it worked out. I'm really happy because we were getting tired of talking to each other because we've been doing that for 15 years.
Is it 15 now? Didn't we have our
maybe
anniversary?
14.
Am I like the kid on the sitcom that like they introduced the young kid?
That was a Simpsons episode that we saw, right? Where it's like there's like
the kids are getting older, so they have to bring in a new young cute looking
kid.
Oh, I didn't see
you
that.
You can name sitcoms throughout the history of television.
Brady Bunch had that kid.
Oliver.
They bring somebody in. Yeah.
Different Strokes.
Another cute kid, yeah.
Growing Pains. I'm sorry, I shouldn't. I'm just.
You're the first guest.
Well, and I'll be happy to come back.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Thank,
well, thank you.
Thank you very much for coming.
Oh, I got to play the closing music because I didn't play that before. Keep talking. Vamp. Oh,
okay.
I'd like to say happy birthday to.
We have some birthdays in the audience. Is that what you're doing?
Andrea.
What, today or?
No.
This
month? I
don't
remember when her birthday was. I think it was in February, though.
My dad's is the 24th.
Of February?
Yes.
All right.
So happy birthday, Dad.
Happy year of the snake.
This has been Radio Zero.